Is my asset a liability? How to let the customer make the sale? And Microsoft blasts Google. All coming up on episode 22 of the Taylor Merrick Podcast, sponsored by GoDaddy.
Welcome to the Taylor Merrick Podcast, the 3-in-1 podcast on finances, business, and technology. Podcasting to you from the studios of TaylorMerrick.com, located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Here's your host, Taylor Merrick.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Taylor Merrick Podcast. In today's episode, you will be learning many new things. But before I begin, I'd like to remind you, if you have any questions, any comments, or any ideas, please use our toll-free line, 1-866-TMP-TMP. 2860, or you can email me, taylor@taylormerrick.com. All questions, comments, or ideas will be read and will be replied to, so please send them in. Also, sign up for updates via email. You can find out more information by going to taylormerrick.com. And as a side note, the chat room and the forums are now open and ready to be used. You can find that by going to taylormerrick.com, and you will find two new buttons that are added. One is called Forums, and the next one is Chat. And you just click on those, and you can start chatting with other people from across the globe. And you can also start speaking with other people in the forums. And I would also like to remind you about the chip-in goal. Goal to raise $70 for new sound effects for the Taylor Merrick Podcast. Now, in today's episode, episode 22, which has been sponsored by GoDaddy. For finances, you'll be learning, is my asset a liability? For business, how to let the customer make the sale? And for technology, it'll be Microsoft blasts Google.
I started catering as a side business. And of course, I wanted to succeed, so I got a domain name and a website from GoDaddy.com. I registered AnsaLights.com.
Just buy any other hot internet product and your .com is just $1.99.
I worried that getting set up on the internet would be difficult. But GoDaddy made it a cinch. Thanks to my .com name from GoDaddy, my business is smoking!
Right now, when you buy any other of GoDaddy's hot internet products, you get your .com for just $1.99.
Plus, enter code POD11 when you check out and save 10% on your web hosting order.
Just go to www.godaddy.com.
It's okay. It's smoked turkey. It's supposed to be like that.
So in finances, is my asset a liability? A very good question to ask. You know the definition of an asset. Anything that puts money into your pocket. Residual money. If it is not putting money in your pocket, it is taking money from your pocket, and that is considered a liability. Now, let's use an example of a car or a house, because your banker says it is an asset. Well, let's sit down and apply this definition. Does this house put money in your pocket? Does this car put money in your pocket? Is it working for you, making you money? If the answer is no, then it is taking money from your pocket. And I'm sure you know that for houses, you have mortgage payment, you have taxes, you have the water and the gas and the upkeep and the maintenance. So, was your banker lying to you when he told you it is an asset? Well, no. Whose asset is it? The home. If you have a mortgage, is the banker's asset, the bank's asset. And your house is therefore a liability to you because it costs you money. Same thing with the car. If you have a car loan, then your car is a liability. Now, unless you take your car and you're renting it out to people or any other number of ideas, I'm sure you can get creative, put money in your pocket, then your car would be considered an asset. But you applying this logic to any item you think is an asset, jewelry, toys that you may have, bookshelves, bookcases, books, anything and everything in your house that you would label an asset. Go take a look, apply this question, is it an asset or is it a liability? Definition of an asset is it puts money in my pocket. If it's not putting your money in your pocket, it is not an asset. It is a liability. Now, can you take a liability and convert it into an asset? Yes, very easily. You just have to come up with a creative way that that so-called liability will put money in your pocket and can turn around and it becomes a liability. Now, if you buy an asset, say a rental property, that would be considered an asset. It's putting money in your pocket. But if it starts costing you money each and every month over and above what the renter pays, you have to pay out-of-pocket expenses for the upkeep of this property, then it is considered a liability. Then that's when it starts costing you money and it'll eat you. Well, what about stocks? Well, stocks are an asset. Yes, it is an asset when it sells and if it sells for a price higher than you bought it at. Now, if you sell it at a price lower than you bought it at, then it's a liability because it cost you money right there. So take this line of thinking and apply it to the objects that you have in your home, house, business, real estate, every area of your life, and find out, is it an asset or is it a liability? If it's a liability, ask yourself this question: how can I make it an asset? And if it is an asset already, how can I keep it such as an asset so it is generating me money? It is only an asset if it is putting money in your pocket. If it is neutral and is not doing anything, it's not an asset. That will wrap it up for the finance portion of this podcast. If you have any further questions, further discussions, please feel free to post on the forums, taylormerrick.com/forum, or you can call it in toll-free, 1-866-TMP-2860, or email me, taylor@taylormerrick.com. I will be glad to help you understand this concept. But that'll wrap it up for finances, and we'll be right back.
This podcast is proudly listed at the best podcasting directory on the internet, podcastpickle.com. We now return you to your regularly scheduled download, already in progress.
This podcast is part of the Blueberry Network. You can find this and other fine podcasts at blueberry.com. That's blueberry without the E's.
Now, as for business, how to let the customer make the sale? How can you let the customer make the sale? There's one person that has answered this and has answered it perfectly. That person is, I'm sure you guessed it right now, Frank Betcher. And Frank Betcher, in his book that I've been going through in this podcast, he says as follows: there's an old Chinese proverb that says, one demonstration is worth more than 1,000 words. A good rule I learned is to never say anything that you can dramatize. Better yet, never dramatize anything yourself that you can get the prospect or customer to do. Let the customer perform. Put him into action. In other words, let the customer help you make the sale. Let's take a few actual examples of how dramatization was used to help make the sale. Number one, General Electric and similar companies I had for years been trying to convince school boards of the need for modern lighting in the schoolrooms. Numerous conferences were held, thousands of words. Results? None. suddenly, one salesman hit on an idea. Dramatization. Standing before the school board in one city, he held a steel rod over his head. Grasping each end with his hands, he bent the rod slightly as he said, "Gentlemen, I can bend this rod just so far, and it snaps right back, allowing the rod to straighten out. But if I bend it beyond a certain point, the rod becomes damaged and will never straighten out again." As he bent the rod beyond its point of elasticity, it snapped slightly in the middle, losing its flexibility. So it is with the eyes of your little children in the schoolrooms. Their eyes will stand just so much strain. Beyond that, their vision is permanently impaired. Result? Money was raised. Modern lighting installed immediately. Number 2. Let's see how a simple little thing like an old-fashioned match was effectively used to dramatize one of the most important selling points of a nationally known refrigerator. Holding a burning match before the customer, the salesman said, "Mr. Hootenanny, our refrigerator is absolutely silent. It is as noiseless as this burning match." Number 3. Most salesmen find it necessary from time to time to submit figures to customers. I found it far more effective when I can get the customer to do the figuring. I just say, "Mr. Henze, will you write these figures down as I give them to you?" I find it gains better attention, holds his interest, and he's less apt to become distracted. It is his own idea at the time. He understands better. He convinces himself with his own figures. In other words, it puts him into action. Later on, coming down to the close, I get him to do the summarizing. I again say, "Mr. Henze, will you write these down?" Then I repeat the summary in fewer words. Number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4. It is a natural climax. He is helping to close the sale himself. Number 4. During a drugstore skit I was giving one night in a sales school in Portland, Oregon, a wholesale distributor of woolen cloth saw me dramatize to a customer a new type of toothbrush. Placing a large magnifying glass in a customer's hand, I handed him the ordinary type of toothbrush, and also the new type. Then I said, "Look at those brushes under the glass, and notice the difference." This cloth salesman had been losing out to competitors who had handled a cheaper grade of cloth. He had been unable to convince customers that good quality was good economy. So he decided to try using a pocket magnifying glass in the same way I had used it to dramatize toothbrushes. I was astonished, he told me later, how readily the customers recognized the difference. My sales increased immediately. Number 5. A New York City haberdasher told me he increased his sales of men's clothing 40% when he installed a movie in his store window. The movie dramatized a shabbily dressed man applying for a position and getting a fast brush off. The next applicant, well groomed, got the job quickly. Good clothes are a good investment, ended the movie. Number 6. My friend Dr. Oliver R. Campbell, Adeline Trust Building, Philadelphia, one outstanding dentist of Philadelphia, recognizes the value of dramatization. He takes x-ray pictures of his patient's teeth and projects them onto the wall of his office. His patient sits there and watches a movie of his own teeth and gums. Dr. Campbell said he used to wear himself out trying to convince patients of the wisdom of taking care of their teeth before it was too late. After he began to dramatize, he got action. Number 7. Here is a demonstration I use in my business that gets action. I use it to dramatize statistics, and I found it impressive with wealthy men. I lay a black fountain pen on a man's desk directly in front of him, place a shiny quarter dollar alongside the pen, and a dime on the opposite side of it. Then I ask, "Do you know what that is?" The man will generally answer, "No, what is it?" I smile and say, "The pen is you when you die. The quarter represents what you have now, and the dime shows all that is left for your wife and children when your executors get through paying taxes and other costs." Then I say, "Mr. Meher, let me ask you one question. Let's suppose for a few minutes you passed out of the picture last month. You and I are the executors. We have got to convert 3/5 of the estate into cash to meet these taxes. How are you going to do it?" Then I let him talk. Rapid strides have been made in dramatization in recent years. It is a surefire method for selling your ideas. Are you making the most of it? Summed up, one demonstration is worth more than 1,000 words. If possible, let the customer perform the demonstration. Let the customer help you make the sale. That is in the words of Frank Betcher. Very knowledgeable advice, and I would encourage you to follow it. And that will wrap it up for business.
This show is a proud member of
the TechPodcast.com network.
Find out more about this and other shows at
www.techpodcast.com.
TechPodcast.com.
If it's tech, it's here.
Now for technology, Microsoft blasts Google. I know you knew it was coming, so did I. But Microsoft is set to launch a blistering attack on Google tomorrow for what the software giant argues is the web leader's cavalier approach to copyright protection. Well, what's going on is a copyright infringement. Microsoft is suing Google for copyright infringement. And this has been going on for 16 months. And in prepared remarks to be delivered to the Association of American Publishers, Microsoft Associate General Counsel Thomas Rubin argued that Google's move into new media markets has come at the expense of publishers of books, videos, and software. And the Microsoft attorney's comments echo arguments at the heart of a 16-month-old copyright lawsuit against Google brought by 5 major book publishers and organized by the Association of American Publishers, an industry trade group. Companies that create no content of their own and make money solely on the backs of other people's content are raking in billions through advertising revenue and IPOs, says Rubin, who oversees copyright and trade secret law at Microsoft. Google takes a position that everything may be freely copied unless the copyright owner notifies Google and tells it to stop, said Rubin, noting that Microsoft takes the position of seeking the copyright's owner consent before they copy. And competition is heating up this year between Google, the world's dominant provider of web search services, and software giant Microsoft, which recently entered the web search market. At the same time, Google has recently expanded into the business software market with a set of web-based subscription services it sees as a major revenue generator, which could chip away at Microsoft's 15-year dominance of computer software. Rubin invokes criticism that Google has faced since its acquisition late last year of YouTube, which has come under fire from several major media companies for allowing widespread copyright infringement of professionally produced video. In essence, Google is saying to you and other copyright owners, trust us, you're protected. We'll keep the digital copy secure. We'll only show snippets. We won't harm you. We'll promote you, Rubin argues in his speech. But Google's track record of protecting copyrights in other parts of its business is weak at best, he said. David Drummond, Google's Senior Vice President for Corporate Development and its Chief Legal Officer, said in response that Google works with more than 10,000 publishing partners to make books searchable online and has recently added the BBC and NBA Basketball League as YouTube video partners. We do this by complying with international copyright laws. End result has been more exposure and in many cases more revenue for authors, publishers, and producers of content, Drummond said. Rubin cites anecdotal media reports that a handful of Google salespeople were caught encouraging advertisers to capitalize on the demand for pirated software on the web. Rubin sides with publishers in criticizing Google's ambitious plan to scan millions of published works in the world's great libraries and make them available to consumers via its Google Book Search system. He said by scanning copies of published works without first seeking copyright holders' permission, Google opens the door to massive infringement. The attorney also says that Google's defense of fair use is overly broad. Concocting a novel fair use theory, Google bestowed upon itself the unilateral right to make entire copies of copyrighted books, Rubin argues. Drummond replied, "The goal of search engines and of products like Google Book Search and YouTube is to help users find information from content producers of every size." The publisher's lawsuit against Google, filed in October 2005 in the U.S. District for the Southern District of New York, remains in the discovery process with no trial date set. Microsoft's move bears parallels to an attack 5 years ago by a Redmond, Washington-based company on so-called open-source software, which has emerged over the past decade as the biggest alternative to Microsoft Windows software franchise. Microsoft argued then that open-source software jeopardized property rights and threatened to undermine the software industry, as it argued in favor of shared-source software that reinforced intellectual property rights. And that is basically, in a nutshell, why Microsoft is blasting Google over copyright infringement. Well, what do you think of this? Good, bad, or otherwise? If you phone them in, or if you write them in, they will be spoken about in a future podcast. Maybe a couple of podcasts from now, or three. But the sooner you get those comments in, phone or text or otherwise, that will wrap it up for technology. I'd like to thank you for listening to episode 22 in the Taylor Merrick Podcast. If you have any questions, any comments, any ideas, call toll-free 1-866-TMP-2860. Don't forget the resources of the forum and the chat boards are available to you. Simply go to TaylorMerrick.com. I am Taylor Merrick, and I will see you next week.